Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 453. Thursday, April 13th, 2023.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, everybody. Well, the free podcast and the paywalled podcast are now out of sync. What you're about to hear is the conclusion of the conversation that started in KMO Show episode number 6, but episode number 7 has already aired. So the vault is now lagging a week behind. At some point, I'll have to get 2 out in a week to get them back in sync, but it's not going to be this week because I have a new puppy and the IRS to contend with. And they're both my fault. I mean, I didn't have to get a dog, and I didn't have to wait this long to do my taxes. But that's the position I'm in. An idealist would say, well, you know, it's all artificial. That deadline is, it's arbitrary. You can file your taxes whenever you want to. Yeah, it's true, but I can't file them in the past, because I didn't file them in the past. And I know that if I file for that extension, that I've got until, what, October to get them done? But that almost guarantees that I won't get them done. So really, it's got to be tomorrow, today, tomorrow, and Saturday. All right, so what you have here is the conclusion of my conversation with Dr. Ashley Frawley. And then, since that conversation doesn't fill an entire hour, I got Kevin Wolmott, who describes himself as a flaming leftist. I got him here to represent not Marxism exactly, because he hasn't studied the foundational Marxist texts, as I have not either. So we couldn't really have an informed, you know, discussion or disagreement about that. But we're going to contrast his political idealism with my political pragmatism, or realpolitik, some people call it. But that's not until the second half of the program. For now, here's the conclusion of my conversation with Dr. Ashley Frawley.
The two things is, one, you want to differentiate what your socialism is or what your leftism is from the other people who want to use that word. So just as in the early 20th century, there were lots of groups who wanted to use the word socialist, now there are lots of people who want to lay claim to a leftist label. Because it's associated with morality and kindness, and right wing is now synonymous with bad and awful and evil and possibly job losing. So there's a lot of reasons for it. So one thing is that you have to, you want to stay within that tradition of kind of like saying, no, 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 this is not what we stand for. This is not socialism. This is not leftism. It belongs to the right. This is clogging our or clouding our ideas of where we need to go. And then the second is self-critique, that yes, this is within the left, we are comrades, but this is wrong and it's probably not helpful. Okay, now if you don't hold on to those two things, what you can wind up doing is differentiating between those. You see the whole HR speak as, when I say HR speak, I'm talking about like critical race theory and stuff like that. You can see that as the left and then project all that is evil onto the left. And then you sound like a fucking fascist. Okay, so you're like, oh, the communists are doing this. Oh, the socialists are doing this. Oh, the leftists are doing this. You see how you have to be very careful with your critiques. And I do try my best to be careful, because it's freaking me out now when I look at discourse online, the way that the left, all this shit that gets associated with the left, is like seen as truly the left. And then it gets the blame for everything that goes wrong in society. And then people say, well, that if that's the left, I'm not part of that. I want nothing to do with it. Instead of saying like, look, this is not what leftism used to be. It's not Marxist to use fucking firing people as a terrorist tool. Like, how on earth can you think that a workers' movement, like, what do you think? Workers are gonna trust you when they fall out of line and you threaten them with a job loss? Do you not think, like, that's probably not a good idea? But this just becomes the left. Anyway, so you have to be careful, because if you just start projecting everything onto the left, even if it's things that are like true, you just sound like a fascist. And that's a really dangerous path to go down.
There's a lot there. I'll say that.
No, I wasn't being super clear. Usually I write notes and I will have like point one, point two, point three. I think I lost it a little.
That's all good. I mean, we can just unpack it. But I'll say that one, what you're describing is a lot of my impatience with trying to force everything into a left-right spectrum. That, you know, people engaging in HR speak, yeah, they're not objecting to, you know, a maldistribution of material goods and opportunity. You know, that's not where they're coming from. They're definitely supporting that structure, which maintains, you know, these vast disparities in wealth and opportunity. But at the same time, they're not right wing. I mean, that wouldn't make sense to call them right wing. So if they're not right wing, are they left wing? I mean, are they centrist? And centrist for folks who describe themselves as leftist is more hated than right wing.
Yeah, and it doesn't help because left and right won't help us to explain that. Because what it is service to neoliberal governance, or I prefer post-liberal governance. I've got an interview up from Diet Soap with David Chandler that the commenters completely misunderstood. I don't know. It's very strange. I've never spent a lot of time on it too. And usually when I spend time on things, like, it goes well, and it hurt actually, because I was like, oh, it's like the first time that it was so badly received. A podcast was so badly received because people didn't understand that what Chandler was describing was a particular form of governance. They thought he was espousing it. And so, because he wasn't the clearest speaker, and he's really frustrating. Like, I really like his neoliberal subject book with Julian Reed. It's pretty clear, but his resilience book is unreadable. It's completely unreadable. And it's a shame, because I think his ideas are really good. One of these ideas that he has is the idea, it's not just his idea, but it's a common idea in international relations, about this neoliberal governance, that there has been a shift from government that sort of does things and moves things around at a higher level, not necessarily for good. I'm not romanticizing this, like, you know, mobilize an army. You don't want to mobilize armies. We don't want to have to do that. But anyways, governments that used to do this sort of thing, and there's been this shift to this sort of like decentralized, horizontal movements of power, governance, like global governance, like the World Bank and International Monetary Fund and the UN and all these overarching sort of systems of global governance. They look like, if you didn't know any better and you read their stuff, you'd think it was like a lefty academic writing this stuff. But these are the systems of global capitalism. These are the systems of global capitalism that are talking about many different capitalisms and gender and women's rights and bottom up, small scale, local. That's how global capitalism works now. So it's not left, it's not right. It's a new kind of neoliberal governance. And let me give you an example of this, because I have been noticing that this is really hard to explain and people don't get it. Like, it took me about 5 tries to explain my use of this to understand mindfulness, and people still didn't get it. Because I wrote an article using some of these ideas in Compact about the destruction of the liberal subject in neoliberal discourses. But anyways, I'll try to give an example. So the EU recently introduced a European Certificate of Parenthood. And what it does is it recognizes, and this is a good thing, by the way, and bad. And it's going to be a little difficult to explain the bad, because it's going to sound really good. So it recognizes, provides an opportunity for parents who are frequently same-sex couples to have their parenthood recognized, even if they are not the biological parent of the child, or if they are the biological parent or parents of the child, but the child is born to a surrogate, often in another country. This creates all kinds of problems, and there are stateless citizens because of this, because of new sort of reproductive technologies and so on. So they've introduced this certificate, which is a good thing. You don't want stateless kids. It causes all kinds of problems. But the certificate also became an underhanded way for the EU to force countries that who claim they're following the democratic will of the majority of their countries in not recognizing either same-sex marriage or the ability for like two mothers to be on a birth certificate. So this has caused a problem, for instance, for some Bulgarian parents who are living in another EU country. They went to go, there was two mothers, and I think it was Spain allowed two mothers to be on the birth certificate. But when they then tried to get a passport for their child, Bulgaria wouldn't recognize that there was that there were two mothers. So a certificate of parenthood would force a country like Hungary or Bulgaria or Poland or whatever to recognize that there are many different kinds of families. Okay. So now I said, this is a good thing. It's a good thing. You don't want stateless children, but it's also a bad thing because you need to win through democratic debate, social change and political change in those countries. Because what happened was this, and this is something that really freaked me out. When this was being tabled in the EU Parliament, an MEP was sort of arguing that this was really bad and it's undermining the family and the family as it is conceived in these countries. And this was a clip that was placed on Twitter. And the comments all underneath were about how communists and leftists were destroying the family, and that they were using all of these underhanded means and these institutions to destroy the family. And that is some fascist shit there. That's really scary. That's really, really scary. But here's the thing. The EU is not full of fucking socialists and communists. I can tell you that for sure. I'm a Marxist. And when I go to the EU, when I go to Brussels and I meet with people from the EU, I feel like, you ever like get in trouble a lot as a teenager and you have to go and talk to the principal in the office in high school? That's what it feels like. Head hung low, you know, berating me. Anyways, the EU is not a socialist or communist institution. It is a institution of neoliberal governance. Okay. And so what happens is that this left-right kind of understanding of things isn't helpful. And thinking of everything through the lens of left and right creates this us versus them thing that is really, really, really dangerous and really, really polarizing. When what is actually happening and a lot of what is getting labeled as like psychotic leftist is actually this neoliberal governance, the sort of structures of trying to influence kind of behaviors and change. Use policies and that are insulated from democratic will to kind of push things around globally and so on, in service of capitalism, And you can't understand it through left and right. But it is not like socialists and communists, like they're not trying to overcome capitalism or something. They are trying to enable it to function better. So like, for instance, like this European certificate of parenthood that I mentioned, yes, it has a progressive ring to it, but what is its purpose? Well, what instigated it all the way back in 2001 was the huge growth of the surrogacy industry, and in particular, surrogacy from surrogates in India, cheaper surrogates and sort of exploiting cheap labor. And that's really controversial. But this certificate or this attempt to kind of smooth out and make that industry function more easily gets sort of recast as a question of LGBT equality. And so it sounds very leftist. And then if you're going to question it, you sound like a right winger, right? When it's none of these things, it is neoliberal governance smoothing out the capital flows globally.
And it generally, you know, the language that is used to justify a coercive policy is always going to appeal to, you know, noble sounding intentions.
Exactly. And when you don't have anything that can penetrate deeper than that, like you're going to get in a lot of trouble. So like the only people like that are standing up for the family and questioning this sort of neoliberal attempt, another example is like rolling back the welfare state, but rolling out childcare and trying to get women into work is cast as equality, but it is not. It's an attempt to get women to take up jobs they wouldn't otherwise take and make it very, very difficult for one parent not to work in family, so that the prerequisite is both parents have to work. Now, the only people who are like asking me to like look into these questions are on the right. They're on the right because they, you know, they have their own reasons. But the only people who are giving me the space to do this are on the right, because no one's willing to take the risk. No one's willing to take the risk to ask about this stuff, right? So European Certificate of Parenthood, well, that sounds really good, must be about LGBT or whatever. And, you know, who's going to have the space or the time or the willingness to look into what's really going on there? Nobody. So it's become like personally also problematic and risky to ask questions because it's framed as just like, oh, well, obviously this is a left-wing thing and only a right-wing monster would question it.
Yeah, I mean, that's how you sell coercive policies to people who consider themselves to be progressive and enlightened.
Yeah, and this is what's happening now. And I can give you a ton of examples of things.
Give me one.
So another one is like, I wrote an article for Compact a while back on, I mixed up all these articles, but if you just go and click my name on Compact magazine, you see all the articles that I've written for them. But in one of these articles, I was talking about it was trauma. How trauma politics hurts the poor. That's the title that they put on the article. And I wanted to write about how trauma implicit, although it sounds really nice and it talks about like historical colonization and all these sorts of things, and it's about decolonization and so on. You scratch below the surface and it is a way of explaining present problems in terms of the psychological pathologies of populations, that they've basically become brain damaged from the past. And I'm Indigenous myself. I'm Ojibwe. My dad is Ojibwe. I'm obviously like mixed with Irish and very white. But I grew up in Ojibwe culture, and these things were like just so hegemonic. Like if you had any problems, you know, I'd ask my sister something, oh, why did our parents do X? And she'd be like, well, Ashley, you know, we never learned to be mothers. And I was like, our mother is white, Tamara. Like, what do you want about? Like, but this is like this, we get all these stock answers that are like, why do we have problems? Because of us. Something that like, yes, it was the colonial government that fucked us up. But at the end of the day, we're the ones who are fucked up. And that's why we have problems. So I want to write about this. And I was doing this literature review, and I've written a lot about this, by the way, it's just a recent article. So I was doing this literature review, as you do before you go and write something new. And I was reading this article from somebody who's doing like critical race theory, something, something. And I was just skimming it and I stopped and I went, wait a second. So there's this sentence that was like, trauma causes emotional, social, and cognitive impairments that can lead to educational underattainment and then inequalities in society and the birth to prison pipeline or whatever. And I was like, hold up, you just said, oh, and they said, and she was saying, and Black people are more likely to be traumatized, and they have this like the trauma of racism and the trauma of this and the trauma of poverty. And this leads to cognitive, social, and emotional impairments that put them in jail. So you just said what puts Black people in jail is that they are cognitively impaired. That's what she said. But you don't notice it because it's all wrapped up in this, oh, the trauma of racism, and it's this, and it's not your fault, you're fucked up. But at the end of the day, you're in jail because you're fucked up. Like, this is what the bell curve, Herrnstein and Murray of the bell curve, that's the argument that they made. And I remember I was sitting in a University of Kent when I was doing my PhD. We used to have Thursday seminars, and I always used to go to these. I went to every single one, regardless of whether or not I was interested. It just always went. They gave you free food and wine after, so that was a big draw. Anyway, and I remember sitting through one and just like sitting there and listening kind of passively. And then I looked up and she said, we did this study in these prisons and we've just found it so awful and so sad. And we really need to lobby around this, that X percentage of the people in there have learning disabilities. And I went, hold up, this is the bell curve again, because that is what they said. But they used IQ. And they said the reason why people are in jail and certain races are more likely to be in jail or in poverty is because of IQ. And now you've just translated it into learning disabilities. But you've just made the same argument that they made. And Herrnstein and Murray were like, absolutely savage. Rightly so, by the way. And a very, very good book that just rips this apart is, well, controversial as well, but it's one of my favorite books, is Stephen Jay Gould's The Mismeasure of Man. It's wonderful kind of rejoinder to that. Anyways, but now you can get away with saying that as much as you want, because you can just change the language and talk about, oh, learning disabilities, and this is so important. We need to raise awareness and get funding for my new program that I'm going to roll out and be part of this social problems class. And I'm going to be part of the solution. Just pay me X amount or whatever, and I'll just get my my promotion. You know, this, and it all sounds great. Sounds great. So these are examples of this kind of rehashing of very old, very racist ideas through a quasi-leftist language and rendering. But it is not leftist. It is not progressive. It is a progressivization of biological racism and biological justifications of inequality and social problems.
I'm smiling at the mention of Stephen Jay Gould.
I love Stephen Jay Gould.
Stephen Jay Gould is a figure who is hated.
No.
Yes. Oh, he's hated by people who are attracted to, you know, the doom narrative that, you know, there'll be people who say that the United States is just as racist now as it was 200 years ago when there was actual slavery, which is just, it's absurd. Mm. It's not even worth, you know, it's not even worth really engaging in a conversation with somebody who's taking a position so contrary to reality. And these are the people that hate Stephen Jay Gould, because he's basically saying, yeah, things are getting better. You know, we treat each other better. Fewer people die from violence now than, you know, in through most of our evolutionary history. Mm-hmm. And even in recorded history, you know, materially, things are much better. We're better behaved. We're better governed.
Less violent. You know,
people are better provided. Yeah. And that is a message that is absolutely anathema to a segment of people that I have encountered regularly, mm. you know, in what I would consider to be the doomosphere, the people who are very attracted to the idea that the lights are about to go out, you know, there's going to be a cascading failure of critical infrastructure, and, you know, maybe it'll be a pandemic, whatever, but some huge epical change is about to sweep over everything and just wash away all the things we hate about modern society. And Stephen Jay Gould is one of the people saying, no, if you just look at the numbers, we're pretty much getting better on every metric. And there's so many people who just don't want to hear that. It's just offensive to them to hear that they're living in a good time.
Yeah. And like, the thing is that people think like, well, if we don't convince people that things are really bad, then they'll never revolt. And they forget, at least my people, people who are Marxists or whatever, or think of themselves in that kind of like socialist kind of tradition or communist tradition, they forget that one of the core tenets of Marxism was that capitalism paves the way for communism. And so when they make these arguments...
Say more about that before you go on. How did capitalism pave the way for communism?
I was going to say the first things first, because it's going to take me a long time to explain how capitalism paves the way for communism. So I'll say the first thing first, which is that, first of all, it is discrediting to sit there and whine that everything is really, really bad, because yes, we have lots of problems and things could be, and I hope they will be, much, much better. And we do have like a really, we do have a real big catastrophe coming. But people look around and they're like, that's just plainly fucking nonsense. Because like, we, you know, 50, 60 years ago, it was 70 years ago, I suppose, you couldn't drink out of the same water fountain as somebody who had who had more melanin in their fucking skin. Like, that's where we were 50, 60 years ago. To deny that things have got better, people are just going to look at you like you're insane, and rightly so. Or like, our living standards have improved. They have. Yes, but we are more precarious, and we have things like sort of dangled over our heads, like threats of job losses and so on. But like, to say that things are really bad and to like also like to look down on the very fact that things have got materially better and to see that as a problem also tells people, well, communists, they want to impoverish you. Like, you know, that's totally backwards. So I think that whole like doom narrative and thinking like if you don't convince people that things are really bad, they'll never revolt, makes you sound like a psychopath and is absolutely not conducive to any forward-looking movement for progress. Because people are like, you don't want things to get better. You just don't want that. And so on this idea of like capitalism creates the basis for communism, we're doing a reading group at Sublation Media. In fact, I have to prepare my stuff for tomorrow, 9 o'clock in the morning, Portland time. We're reading Notebook 5. We're getting to the good stuff because it's these are the notebooks, the later notebooks where Marx gets really, really excited. And it's really uplifting and cool stuff. Anyways, so capitalism has enabled us to produce a surplus and produce just generally beyond the wildest dreams of our ancestors. It gives us the ability to provide not just a basic or decent standard of living for all human beings on Earth, but a very, very good and excellent standard of living for all human beings on Earth. The problem is that that is not why capitalism makes those things. Capitalism does not introduce technological progress necessarily to make people's lives better. That is a sort of accidental offshoot of technological progress. Machinery in the production process is erroneously called labor-saving technology because it doesn't actually save any labor. You work just as long. But you work, it allows your boss to appropriate more of the value that you make during that time. So you work just as long, the machine saves the boss having to pay out more on wages. That's why the machine is introduced. So John Stuart Mill talked about this in the 19th century. Sorry, for a second I got confused. In the 19th century, I was like thinking Mill was 20th century, my brain like disappeared there for a moment. Anyways, John Stuart Mill talked about this in the 19th century. He said, oh, he's just sort of remarks, oh, it's interesting that all this technological progress doesn't seem to have made anyone's lives easier. And Marx laughs at this in Capital. And he says, yes, because that's not its point. That's not the point of technology. The point is you will work just as hard, if not harder, when the machine is introduced. It just allows it's introduced not to make your life easier, but to bring down variable capital, bring down the cost of wages. So now the same amount or more can be produced with fewer workers. Anyways, so all of these things, however, have a contradictory offshoot, which is that they give us the potential to produce quite a lot in a short period of time, which means that in a different kind of society, we could work much less. We could do whatever, 2 hours of necessary labor, and have a lot more free time and do work that we want to do. Work would become not this thing that we hate and avoid like the plague, but life's prime want, Marx says. Anyways, so large-scale industry allows for this. And there's a certain section of so-called Marxists, which I just find absolutely insane, and they tend to be like the worst and most rabid lunatics. They really hate me and they're mean. They are mean about how much they hate me. But they will swear up and down that Marx was anti-industry. And I just cannot see how they could possibly read Marx himself rather than the disillusioned new left of the post-Second World War and come to that conclusion. Because if you read Marx, he very clearly is in awe at industry and how it destroys it. It creates the possibility for the future and it destroys itself. It destroys production under capitalism. This is the contradiction. So in the Communist Manifesto, Marx says the capitalist is like a sorcerer who's unable to control the powers that he's conjured up from the netherworld. So capitalism produces this enormous amount of wealth, but this then makes it difficult to make a sufficient profit. And profit is the lifeblood that allows it to make this enormous amount of wealth. So the very thing that allows it to continue is also the thing that destroys it. And so he says, the fact that in the Communist Manifesto, they write, this produces a situation that in all earlier epochs would have appeared an absurdity, a crisis of overproduction. And he doesn't mean overproduction of use values, of useful things. How can you have overproduction when, especially during Marx's time, good portion of even the Western world was starving? He means overproduction for some asshole to make a profit off of it. So how could you have overproduction? That's madness. So what happens is that capitalism then begins to destroy wealth instead of creating it. So during an economic crisis, it's like all of a sudden there was a famine. They're like five. Now this is why I said a catastrophe is coming. A fucking massive economic crisis is coming. And I've been calling this for, well, I've been calling it for 10 years. See? So it was about to happen at some point. But the reason I've been calling it for 10 years is because we never overcame the contradictions of the 2008 financial crisis.
Alrighty. So do you know the Silicon Valley axiom, too early is the same as wrong?
Oh, well, no, here's the thing. I have a reason though. And the reason I said that I was specific as well. I said, we will have another economic crisis within the next decade, and a war. And this was a significant prediction because most people think that you can have proxy wars, you can have wars in like the Middle East and whatever, but not country on country warfare. You're not going to declare war on another country because of mutually assured destruction. But the push factors toward destruction are so powerful. Nobody really wants war, but the sort of underlying interests are pushing in that direction. And I don't mean like someone's like, ooh, I want to have a war. Let's have a war. It's like when you can't build bridges, you build bullets and you build tanks.
If you're a shareholder in Raytheon, you want war.
Yes, yes.
That's money in your pocket.
Yeah, so there's a problem now where they're not a problem now. There's been a problem for about 60 years since the previous World War, where there are dwindling avenues for productive investment. And in order to explain this properly, I would need to explain all of the labor theory of value and the falling rate of profit. So I would just, if you are interested in what I'm talking about and how capitalism can lead to war, I highly recommend an interview that I did with the political economist Rick Kuhn on Diet Soap. You just Google that and it walks you through every step of this theory. But anyways, so capitalism winds up destroying wealth. This is the thing. This is why I don't give a shit. I can sing the praises of capitalism all day long, and everybody thinks I'm a right winger because of this. And no, you have to say it's horrible, it's horrible, it's this bad system and everything's getting worse. No, I can be real. Things are getting better, obviously. But the problem is that capitalism cannot continue this way forever. It will destroy things. This is why Marx says that when capitalism begins to destroy itself, it becomes obvious that it is not an absolute system for the production of wealth, but at a certain point comes into contradiction with wealth. And now we know it is a transient historical system, just like feudalism at a certain point was a productive system, but became a fetter on productivity and on progress. It was burst asunder. So too is capitalism becoming a fetter on progress, and it must be burst asunder. This is what they say in the Communist Manifesto. Very basic stuff, and people just miss it. It's astonishing to me. Anyways, so it is so 5 minutes ago, let's say 2007 or something, 2006, everybody's whining and whining that capitalism produces too much and this is bad for your soul. 2008, where did everything go? Now there's not enough. Was there a famine? No, you've got commodities rotting in warehouses while people starve. You've got houses that lay empty while people sleep on the streets. That is fucking insane. If an alien came down to Earth and was like, and we're like, oh yeah, we got this problem where like people are starving, and they're like, but you're burning all that wheat over there, and why don't you eat that food? And we're like, we've got a system where we produce the food based on these beans here, these beads, and something's happened with the beads, so we're just burning all the food. Yeah, you understand. The alien would be like, perhaps you should figure out a system in which you can go over there and eat the food instead of dying. Would that sound like a good idea to you? Yeah, I think that sounds like a good idea. So this is what makes me a Marxist and a communist. because obviously I'm an alien. No. What makes me a Marxist and a communist is that I believe in progress. I believe in wealth. I believe that all human beings deserve not just a decent or basic standard of living, but a great standard of living. And it makes me angry that it is possible and we are constantly told we can't have it. And for a leftist to say that you can't have it, I think is unforgivable. And it's gonna, and I'm scared because capitalism will destroy us all before it makes the world any better. You know, that's what I am scared. So it's a lot is at stake to be messing around by saying, oh, well, the whole world is just a billion times racist than ever, and to get pissed off about language games and so on. Like, oh my God, be real. Like, yes, things are getting better and they can be even better than this. And that's what we're fighting for here. But everybody's just kind of lost the plot.
Well, I agree with a lot of what you're saying. I think it would come as no surprise to you that, you know, I'm not a Marxist, not, you know, I'm just inherently suspicious of ideology in general.
Well, it's spoken like a true Gen Xer.
Yeah. But, you know, when people talk to me about a Marxist revolution, you know, I look at self-described Marxists and their greatest passion seems to be in criticizing one another.
Yeah.
Like the right-wing bourgeois capitalist monsters, yeah, they're terrible, but the people I really, really can't stand are the ones who don't get Marx the way I do. And, you know, so much of the fervor the fervor in their rhetoric is directed against, you know, what from the outside looks like their own in-group. So you get terms like the circular firing squad.
Yeah, and maybe I just fired off of my own circular firing squad. But, like, I don't know. I think when you said, like, Marxist revolution, I mean, no revolution is going to be led by somebody like me, I don't think, sitting in my living room. You know, people are empirical. They go out into the world, and when they cannot feed themselves and they cannot keep a house in a world in which there's plenty of food and lots of houses, they're going to get mad. They're going to get mad, and they get mad over and over and over again. And we get an ideological onslaught that attempts to say, you know, the Gilets Jaunes, for instance, in France, when Macron tries to put the burden of environmental progress on the working class so that they can't even afford to live anymore. They get mad, right? And then you get this ideological onslaught. So, oh, wow, they're all a bunch of racists, and aren't they a bit sus and all this? Well, this is what will happen, I think. This is what's happened in the past. And there does need to be organization. There does need to be an organization. But I don't know. I'm feeling a little bit hopeless now at the moment, not just after this, in this conversation. But I think that people, just people, humans, they don't need to be Marxists. You know, Marx writes in the German ideology, the masses are not waiting with bated breath the resolution of theoretical questions. They solve them in the world. You know, they go out into the world and they try to solve these problems. And so when there was like that truckers protest, a lot of my family was there, like it's sort of a lot of indigenous people were there, which nobody talks about. They're like, oh, that's a bunch of racists. Like, anyway.
A word which has completely lost its power from overuse.
I know. And then you see like stuff that I was saying getting put across as like anti-racism, you know, this idea that Black people are cognitively impaired, that's supposed to be anti-racist. It's just a world turned upside down. Anyway, you know, I would have been there, I would have joined in the discourse, you know, and tried to learn and both be learned from, which is what I was doing. I was like talking to my brother and my aunt who were there. My aunt and I talked until she had lost her voice, you know, and I wish I could have been there. But yeah, I think to the extent that I would ever be part of a movement, it would be like joining in and trying to give it a little bit of direction and learning, trying to learn from the past. You know, I don't know what's going to happen. I think it's much more likely that we'll have like a great big world war, and the disarray of any kind of progressive movement means that anything that people like me probably are totally irrelevant.
Well, when the nukes start flying, yes, all talk. Is pretty useless. At that point, you just need to get inside, underground if possible, take your iodine if it's available, and have a lot of fresh water on hand. But I'm absolutely not a survivalist by any stretch. If there's a nuclear war, I want to be at ground zero. I want to be vaporized. I do not want to die of radiation poisoning, and I certainly don't want to be killed by people who are after my stuff.
I don't know. I mean, what I am saying is, like, a lot of deep theory that gets you to this position of just, I think, understanding what's happening. But I think it's also something that people intuitively understand. As I said, like, you know, in 1917, people had an option. Do you want to go die for the Tsar? Or do you want to opt out of this war and take things into our own hands? Now, of course, they had the benefit of an organized, the Bolsheviks, and things went to shit also, obviously. The USSR is no beacon of progress, or I don't know, a little bit, but it's not.
Are you allowed to say that?
What's that?
I said, are you allowed to say that the Soviet Union was not a beacon of progress?
Yeah, I mean, in lots of ways it was, obviously. Like, you can't be stupid and throw the whole thing out. It was the very first attempt for humanity to emancipate itself. And obviously it didn't, we were never able to overcome the law of value, just the regulating force, the power, productive force of and destructive force of capitalism. We were never able to overcome that. Humanity has not yet figured out another way to organize things, but we might.
What do you think of the idea that no human really needs to figure out in advance what the successful strategy is going to be going forward for the human race and the human civilization?
Yeah. So that's, I think a better way to understand how things might move forward, if they will move forward, because it's not inevitable, is to think about how they did in the past. And so if you think about the move from feudalism to capitalism, it's not like people were like, here's how we will organize things. You know, things were already developing in a particular way, and it was up to the revolutionaries to be, you know, what was the metaphor is the midwives of the new society, right? And so whatever comes next, if anything will come next, it already exists now. You know, capitalism is pregnant with the future. And I just don't know how it will be born. And I don't think you necessarily do know how or need to know in advance or will know in advance, because I hope, in the same way that capitalism was already developing and was being held back by the old forces, our new society is already developing and is simply being held back to know. I mean, it'll look a lot like capitalism, I'm sure. It'd be like, Comrade Alexa, we're out of paper towels.
I'm going to turn off Comrade Alexa so that I can mention her name without her pricking up her ears.
That would have been great. But yes, what do you want? I am listening, and now you are on a list.
Yes. Well, she might just say, what brand of paper towels do you want? How many? I mean, Alexa is here to be my always-on voice interface with the Amazon ecosystem, which is why they don't give it away for free exactly, but I got my first one for like $30. And then I had some complaint about it. It was still working, but I was on tech support with somebody for like 15 minutes and they couldn't get the issue resolved, and they just sent me a new one. It's like,
that, there you go. Like, there's communism right there. Like, prices go to zero. Say, we're almost there. It's destructive and horrible for capitalism, but that's a great thing for humanity. Something that, a technology that earlier people would have thought was magic, basically.
Oh, you're dangling bait in front of me, but we're at an hour and 27 minutes on the recording right now. So as tempted as I am to chase that rabbit, I'm going to say, Ashley, it has been enjoyable talking to you. We probably, if that was our program, could find things to disagree on and like really bare our teeth and go at it. But those aren't the kinds of conversations that I like to have or, promote in the world. So it is very enjoyable to talk to somebody who's read a lot of books and written a lot of papers and books, and is also comfortable on the microphone. It's a great combination. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
That was Dr. Ashley Frawley. And now, to help me digest the information we all just heard, is Kevin Womit in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Kevin, good to see you again.
Good to see you again. Many miles away this time.
Yes, and I've had a major life change. I now have a dog.
Can you hear my dog barking in the background? He's barking right now.
I cannot. My pup is munching on a bone just a few feet away from me. And she's not quite 4 months old, and she's already like 25 pounds. She's going to be a big dog.
Big old dog. I like big dogs. I like dogs that make a thump noise when you pat them on the chest.
Yeah, I do too. And seems like she's, like, I know she's half lab. Her dad was a lab, but it also looks like maybe she's got some Anatolian Shepherd in her. Mm-hmm. They're very big dogs, but, you know, the big cattle guarding dogs tend to be very sedate and gentle.
Yeah.
I think the Great Pyrenees is probably a better known example of that type of dog. But they're not herding dogs. They're not meant to run around all day. They're meant to just kind of hang out with the livestock and kill the wolves when they show up.
Right.
Or be killed by the wolves.
Or die trying.
Yes, exactly. All right. So, I've been immersed in talk of artificial intelligence recently, but I did take a break from it to talk with Dr. Ashley Frawley, who is Doug Lane's right-hand man at Sublation Media. And, the whole Sublation Media project really is, it's criticizing the so-called left from the Marxist left. Basically rejecting, wokeism in favor of old school Marxism. And maybe that's not a fair, assessment, but those are not my politics. So I think you're probably closer to Ashley and Doug politically than I am. So let me just get your reaction to what you heard both on the KMO show and then the bit of it, the bit of the second half that you got through, which the listeners just heard.
Right. Well, obviously, I was interested in that episode, first of all, because I am a child of the 90s. I mean, I was born a couple years before you, but I grew to adulthood in the 90s and listened to a lot of the same music. And Ashley was talking about going out with musicians and local bands. And you know that I'm very deep into the local band scene. So Ashley apparently grew beyond it and said that she cringed at those memories, but I'm still mired in it. So it was fun to hear the 90s part of that conversation. This is sort of a perennial problem. It's, to use a religious analogy, the Catholics make a distinction between dharma and dogma, or is that the Buddhists? I think it's basically people who study religion apply these words to the Catholic Church and to other religions. And you could make an argument that Marxism is a religion. You could also make an argument that capitalism is a religion. But the point of Marxism is to get together and have groups of people have democracy and autonomy. And then it gets bogged down when you try to implement it. That's the difference between the dogma of the Catholic Church that ended up burning Galileo in a pot, that kind of thing, versus the dharma, which is the intention to have everyone saved. And it's sort of a perennial human problem. And this is just something we were dealing with especially acutely at this phase. Marx wrote down a lot of good stuff in his books. I haven't actually read his books. I've read some excerpts. But the point of Marxism is not to institute this or that institution, but to try and get people health care and food. And I think that's what Ashley is talking about. I definitely resonated with the things that she said. Like she said about canceling and firing people is not Marxist, because the point of Marxism is to employ as many people to the degree that they're capable of being employed.
She mentioned, toward the end, maybe you didn't get this far, but she was talking about how capitalism basically leads to mass starvation. And I thought that was hyperbolic, because even the poorest of the poor here in the U.S. are as likely to be overweight as they are to be skeletal. We are awash in cheap calories. And while you might be swimming in debt and you might be having great trouble, collecting the money to pay rent, you're not going to go hungry. There's plenty of free food available. That's not necessarily, a rejoinder to anything she said, other than just, I think some of the rhetoric is, it's past its pull-by date and probably needs to be updated. But I think maybe the problem is when you go to update Marx, it's pretty hard to do without injecting current politics into it, which is probably not appropriate.
Right.
But, you know, like you, I haven't read primary materials, or, you know, haven't read the Communist Manifesto or Capital, or, you know, much less some of the more obscure stuff. But I've read summaries of it. I've talked to a lot of Marxists, and, you know, my general reservation is, you know, I just look at history, and every time somebody overthrows a government based on this rhetoric, there's a lot of bloodshed, and it's typically not, you know, the military, and it's not necessarily the civil service that's being abused. It's just normal people, you know, who get shipped off to re-education camps and labor camps, or just, you know, murdered in mass. And that's, I'm not sure where I said it, but recently I said, it was probably on Twitter, actually. I said that I'm not in love with the capitalist system by any stretch. I'm certainly a critic of its excesses, and I'm certainly a critic of the U.S. imperial project when it breaks bad. And all that said, I don't trust radical, you know, ideological young people who overthrow the current system by violence to create anything that is even nearly as humane and workable. You know, I think basically you get the bloodbath, you get the reprisals, and then you also get a breakdown of the current system, which leads to chaos. And as Littlefinger on Game of Thrones was fond of saying, chaos is a ladder. You know, when you create chaos, you're basically creating opportunities for the most ruthless people in our population to grab power. So that's why I'm not a revolutionary in any sense. And, you know, I'm an intellectual and I'm old, and if there's fighting in the streets, I will not be a part of it. And, you know, most people in any sort of revolution are not a party to it. It's small cadres striking strategically at, you know, a power structure which is grown corrupt and is not really functional and not even able to defend itself. Anyway, that's a lot of words, me saying. Let me stop and let you say some words.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of that to try and respond to. Well, first of all, absolutely, you're right that rhetoric needs updating. I often describe our whole culture as being conservative, and that we don't want to let go of things that really we really should let go of. And
disconnected.
Oh crap! That's my hang on just a second.
No worries.
There. Anyway.
What was that? What kind of AI was talking to you there?
You know, I want to write a fiction story about a beepologist who identifies what computer is beeping and saying what, because people getting to be our age and older cannot figure these things out. Well, so I have a Bluetooth speaker that I was listening to the part two of Ashley on as it was being broadcast from my main computer in my living room, and I was brushing my teeth in the bathroom. right, I just lost Bluetooth, basically. I think it went to sleep. The only feasible use I can think of for AI is to help us make our friggin' technology actually work, because our technology is so complicated. But
I absolutely agree, but let's save that for the second portion of the conversation. Right now,
we're
still on Marx.
Still on Marx. Okay, I was just saying, yes, we need to update rhetoric, and like I was saying about Dharma and dogma, the idea is that, you know, spirituality adopts dogma as kind of like a shell. This is what I was taught in religious school, like a hermit crab or something. And so these words, you know, we can't communicate anything without words. So Marx had to write down his Communist Manifesto in order to communicate his ideas. But at some point, you know, the needs of the people, the needs of the spirit outgrow the shell, and it has to be discarded. The words have to be discarded, but the idea is to help people. How did I even get on that? So I was trying to respond to your point about, you know, I can't remember where Ashley said that capitalism starves people, but there's a number of responses to that. Number one, you know, you cite obesity, but I always have to point out the counterexample of people who are starving in Africa are bloated. They look fat, but we don't have good quality food here. It's not the same thing, but we're not getting good nutrition.
No, you're talking about people with distended bellies because their bellies are full of gas, but their limbs are skeletal. Their faces are skeletal. They're not fleshy.
All I'm trying to say is that
they're just bloated.
All I'm trying to say is that you can't put everything into appearances. We're not getting good nutrition from capitalism because what is easily and cheaply mass producible is not the healthiest thing for us. And that's a conundrum because we can't all, you know, 300 million of us can't just all live back on the land on farms and stuff. You know, our population is too big for that. but capitalism is not the it has a lot of room for improvement. Okay, let me stake out a couple of things.
Go ahead.
First of all, talking about revolutionaries, for one thing, okay, you know, I was alive during the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia. I wasn't in Czechoslovakia, but I happened to be studying on an exchange program in East Berlin, back when there was an East Berlin, you know, 6 months before the wall fell. And my German friends told me at the time, the two Germanys will never reunite. They've grown too different. They're two different countries now. And then 6 months later, people were dancing on the broken pieces of the wall. So things like that can happen. Now, that's kind of a counterintuitive example for me to propose, because that was a revolution going from allegedly communist to capitalist. But my point is, these things can change really quickly, and they don't always have to be violent. The Velvet Revolution wasn't violent. You know, the two Germanys reunited. Now, even though we might...
But again, that's the unwinding of Marxist communism. That's not the imposition of okay. it. The imposition of it tends to be violent.
Okay, but is that a piece of dogma that is really necessary to the spirit of Marxism? I mean, what I always say is that these excesses and the violence that people talk about is totalitarianism. Totalitarianism is not necessarily a part of Marxism. You know, leftism can be decentralized.
Isn't it? Isn't Marx's program, there will be a revolution, and then for an indeterminate period, there will be a dictatorship of the proletariat, which will be an explicitly authoritarian project. Dictatorship of the proletariat. I mean, I think even in, you know, from the man himself, the man with the beard, yeah, it will be an authoritarian, totalitarian system for a time until the need for that fades away, and then it just becomes a you know, a more utopian sort of arrangement where everybody knows what is required of them and what they need to do, and they just do it. That's my understanding. Again, not a Marxist scholar, but somebody who is very cautious about people who propose tearing down what works before they can impose something that they think would be better.
Okay, let me repost there. So that's, again, getting back to what I say. Marx is a dogma. He's not necessarily the Dharma. And, you know, since I haven't read Marx, I don't have a huge allegiance to him. I don't see why we can't implement universal health care in the United States without a revolution. And this is, there's several.
Well, then you're not a Marxist. You're a reformer. The Marxists hate the reformers.
Maybe I'm not Marxist, but I'm a far leftist. I'm not a reformer because I want to throw everybody out. I consider Biden to be on the right, that kind of thing. You know, I'm constantly under attack from the centrists. You were talking with Ashley about how people who implement leftist policies for corporate reasons hate being called centrist, and that's my experience too. Getting back to Ashley there for a minute, you know, I'm constantly surrounded by people who say I'm on the left, but we, you know, is universal healthcare really a good thing? Shouldn't people have skin in the game? That kind of thing. Oh, there's multiple responses to this. One of the responses, you know, also to when people chafe at my being, you know, somewhat revolutionary, I have to say, It's been the experience of history that power doesn't give up significant reforms without a credible threat of revolution, of being overthrown completely. Not necessarily a violent revolution, but you're only going to get healthcare concessions if you threaten to eliminate the insurers. It's got to be a credible threat. It can't be like what the Democrats, especially Obama, do about saying, we'd like these reforms, but if you don't want them, you know, I guess we're going to have to make do. That is not a credible threat, and nothing comes of that. So that's part of my revolutionary posture, is that there has to be a credible threat. And I think there was one in the 30s in the New Deal when we got these concessions. But my broader point is that when I say I'm a revolutionary, you know, I cite the example of the Velvet Revolution because that was a total changeover of system. I'm talking about the way that a change looks as being a revolution. It's not so much that the Velvet Revolution was a winding down of communism because that system was going there. It was the replacement by something else. And then we take the example of what happened in Russia in the 90s. There was a nonviolent changeover to the capitalist system, and it produced tremendous chaos. you know, the life expectancy of Russians dropped by a decade and something like 3 years, and people who were rich were out on the streets selling their jewelry to buy food. I don't think it's valid to say that communism is always violent when it's instituted and capitalism isn't, because that kind of thing happens. It depends a lot on, you know, where you draw your lines and where you draw your boundaries. The rejoinder to the argument people always say about, oh, communism had the, you know, Mao had the Great Famine and the Stalinist famines and stuff like that. Yeah, well, capitalism was invented to promulgate slavery, and millions of Africans died in slavery. And people say, oh, well, that's not capitalism. That was 200 years ago. Well, okay, communism is new. Capitalism is old. Capitalism started out by shipping these people in steerage and killing millions of them, causing a lot of misery and starvation. So the point is to avoid the misery and the starvation and the totalitarianism. That's something of what I was saying.
So, draw a breath. Yeah, take a breath. You don't have to, you're not the only guy at the Ramparts defending leftism from me, you know, so you have your comrades. It's not all on your shoulders. There's no pressure here. We're just talking.
And I'll just sneak in one thing that in our previous conversation before before you interviewed Ashley on the Sea Realm
KMO show,
I think I mentioned, I don't know, KMO show. Okay. So we were talking, before that, before Michael, you had me on the Sea Realm vault when we were both sitting in Russell and Mark's house. Anyway, I can't remember if it made it into the cut or not, but I think it might have been a comment I put on your Patreon. But I did read somebody pointing out the places that have had these communist revolutions like Russia and China and even Cuba started out from a system of deep imperialist exploitation. So even though the communists, you know, had a lot of misfortunes and starved people and implemented bad policies, it was still a step up from what they had before. And this is what I'm saying about totalitarianism is not a part necessarily of the communist revolution, but it's all that they knew in these real life historical examples in Russia and China. You know, these imperialist systems before the revolutions were extremely totalitarianism for their time, you know, for the 19th century. I just have the hope that as things go on, you know, we have all these examples of history to look back on. People don't tolerate totalitarianism anymore. That's kind of our problem in the United States. We can't get people to all go the same way. It's like herding cats. So I just have a lot of trouble imagining that totalitarianism is going to fly in the United States. But the communist policies like universal health care, free education, I don't see why they can't. I don't see why you need totalitarianism to implement those things.
Well, we have socialized education already. So that's not a stretch for anybody. Anybody's imagination. And in terms of socialized medicine, I mean, basically everybody but us does it. So it's very, you know, it's demonstrably possible in a capitalist system. That's not an issue.
Throw in a comment there. That was something you mentioned in the CRM vault when you had me on, that the United States Empire gives universal health care to its client states. I had read an article that I tried desperately to find the citation, but there was some indication from papers by George Marshall, was it, of the Marshall Plan, that the United States inflicted universal health care on those states because they thought that socialism was inferior to capitalism, and this would be a disadvantage. Having socialist, you know, social welfare states would be a disadvantage on those nations of Germany and Japan that would prevent them from competing with the United States in the future. So it had mixed results. You know, the United States is still at the head of the economy, but in terms of human, you know, happiness ratings and satisfaction and healthcare outcomes, it did not work the way that they expected it to.
Well, what you're citing is news to me. I'm not familiar with that source, but I've lived in Japan.
Yeah, I wish I could.
I've lived in Japan, and I know they don't have socialized medicine in Japan. What they have is affordable healthcare. My point wasn't that the United States, you know, gives the imperial client states certain rights for their citizens. The United States is just very permissive in how those governments want to proceed. But with Germany and Japan, you know, since the U.S. essentially rebuilt those countries after World War II, we we set them up such that they would not be directing their resources into a military to challenge us militarily. And that was an enormous boon for their economies. But my larger point was basically just this. If for people who complain about the, you know, the overbearing, nasty, you know, imperial United States, what other empire in history has allowed the citizens of its client states to live better than the citizens of the empire? You know, here in the United States, yeah, we're really stressed. We're in deep debt. We have great job insecurity, and lots of people like me make too much money to get the Medicaid free healthcare and not enough to afford, you know, what everybody else has. And we're a growing class. And, you know, here we are in the center of the empire, and that's how we live. But if you're in Germany, or if you're in Japan, or if you're in Canada, you don't really worry about healthcare. It's not a big deal, you know, because the citizens have a higher standard of living. They have more security. They have a greater social safety net. And, you know, the evil, overbearing empire has no complaints about that. You know, go ahead, treat your citizens well. That's good on you, whatever. We don't care. Just, you know, go along with us when we tell you what's going to happen militarily.
Yeah. Well, that's all great until they try and nationalize the oil business, and then we send in the troops. But
not to our client states. Not the United States is not going to be sending troops. I mean, there are U.S. troops in Great Britain. There are U.S. troops in Germany. There are U.S. troops, not a whole lot, but, you know, at the ports in Australia. But they're not an invading army. You know, those countries are willing participants in this structure, and they benefit enormously from it, and they know it. So, you know, what you got your Caitlin Johnstones saying, oh, evil U.S., they're, you know, they've got a gun to our head. The U.S. does not have a gun to Australia's head. The U.S. is providing nuclear submarines to Australia. You know, we're not, they are not in chains. They are willing junior partners in a very successful program. And they've gotten a better deal than we imperial subjects do, you know, the official citizens of the empire.
Yeah, so that's my point. Well, you could make that argument that we have a certain benevolence overseas, but what good does that do me? You know, I spent several years without healthcare. And more importantly, when I try and lobby for healthcare, how come there's such an immense political campaign to suppress me?
Because, you know, it's an enormously profitable business, and the healthcare lobby in Washington, D.C. is, I think it is the largest. I think the drug lobby is the one that spends the most money. And, you know, they're either first or they're just behind the you know, the arms manufacturers.
I believe you're right, but yeah, so that's the pragmatic answer. But my question is, you know, first of all, you know, I try to label very few things, very little about our foreign policy as evil, although, you know, we do tend to promote war because of that defense industry, and that's pretty evil. But what's evil is to claim that I have some kind of representation and vote, and then there's this immense political campaign to try and silence me on all different fronts, you know, not only the healthcare, but the education, you know, energy, just everything. So why shouldn't I treat that as evil when it's suppressing me?
Well, I think it's because you have a premise, you're working from a premise, which might be true and it might be false. I'm leaning towards false, but I'm not dogmatic about it. But the premise is this, that if the rank and file, if the hoi polloi, you know, if the people actually get to determine policy, that that's going to generate a more stable and humane form of government than, you know, the sham democracy that I think we have now, where, you know, basically we have a technocracy. We've got a lot of special interests, which have captured the portions of the government that are supposed to regulate their industries. But even so, and that's a bad thing from my perspective, but even so, I don't know that it would be a better situation if government policy actually reflected the will of the people. Because I think that the people are demonstrating themselves to be quite fickle and also very, very short-sighted. So, you know, but I am definitely not somebody who is touting a patriotic line saying, yes, the United States is a true democracy. We really do, you know, allow the people to dictate how, you know, people in power operate, and that there is accountability, and that the ballot box is the ultimate form of accountability. I think that's all garbage. I think that is childish fairy tale talk. You know, the United States is, it is a huge, very complicated, I would say complex adaptive system that has multiple power centers that are at odds with one another. And that internal antagonism, I think, even provides a sort of stability as it prevents the undue accumulation of too much power in any single locus. Now, granted, there's a lot of, accumulated, unearned power and influence in Washington, D.C. and in Silicon Valley and in, you know, various places. The oil industry, for sure, largely in Texas and California. But because there are so many power centers, it's not a dictatorship. And all of these different power centers have a vested interest in maintaining stability. And really, stability, which is to say a lack of open warfare between major power centers, is the best thing that you can do for a population. You know, all talk of job guarantees and healthcare and adequate nutrition, all of that comes behind stability. Without stability, none of that other stuff is possible.
Yeah, definitely. There's some responses to that. Number one, or what I think of is that the stability that you're talking about doesn't stand still. Nothing stands still. Society changes. You know, the power centers react to different things in different ways. And what's happening right now is that the power centers in Washington have decided that suppressing information and controlling information and censorship is good now, you know, which is a recent development. You've talked a little about this on your show, not a whole lot, but you read people like Matt Taibbi and Glenn Greenwald and stuff. You know, you don't have to agree with their actual stances, but it's very clear, and you know, from these Twitter files, that the government is taking an active hand in suppressing information to make sure the citizens think the way that the people in Washington approve of, quote unquote. And I don't, you know, what I take from history and especially from communist societies is that that never works in the long term. People are always discontent. Bringing it back to Ashley was talking about the frustration of the working classes. People know that this is being done to them. I think it was Adam Curtis said that people get resentful when they realize that they are to be governed rather, they're to be managed rather than governed, which I thought was a good phrase. You know, if you're not a citizen, you're just sort of a consumer. And what happens is that eventually those systems get overthrown, that the stability is not permanent. It can't be permanent. It was even, John F. Kennedy, a mainstream politician, who had that famous quote, "Those who make peaceful reform impossible make violent revolution inevitable." When you have a revolution that's fueled by this frustration and resentment, that's when you get the blood in the streets and the terrible policies and so forth. That's what I was saying about the existing revolutions. You know, they were fueled by frustration under literal imperial empires, you know, the Tsar and the Chinese Mandarins and so forth. The citizens were frustrated, so they had a bloody revolution. That's the sort of thing I would like to avoid. And I also have to acknowledge what you say. Most Americans are very leery of revolution, and it's for a good reason. But I do think we can have that sort of thing nonviolently if we try.
So let me just ask you, which faction in the U.S. imperial government is currently demonizing Matt Taibbi?
Oh, it's the mainstream Democrats. You know, if it doesn't sound like you followed the Twitter files a lot, but the Office of Homeland Security, the Biden administration, would make requests to Twitter about very low level people, you know, people with a dozen followers, you know, block this guy, you know, downgrade this guy because he's saying something that we don't like to hear. And there's like an Office of Information Management or something. There's several different offices. I can email you some articles. I don't have them at the top of my head. But they've invented a new category. You know, there's information, there's disinformation, and now there's malinformation. You know, have you commented on that on your podcast? But you know what I'm talking about.
I forget who I was talking to about that recently, but...
it was Doug Lane. Yeah, he was saying
okay.
That.
Yeah, Matt, so for people who didn't hear that conversation or don't remember, malinformation is information that is true, but which might lead people to do things that the power structure doesn't want them to do.
The quote-unquote wrong conclusion. You know, that should freaking terrify any rational human being. And
I think that's exactly the faction that Ashley and Doug are, you know, are criticizing and pushing back against, saying that's not the left.
Exactly. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. But You often say that this left-right dichotomy is not useful, and it's true. We're moving beyond this into uncharted territory, but it's the Democrats who are really pushing this line about control of information and malinformation, and it doesn't show any signs of slowing down. And the Democrats are the people who are assumed by default to be on the left in this country, partly because of what Ashley was talking about in her vault interview about because the bureaucrats and the capitalists institute leftist identitarian policies because they think it'll sell better. So people assume, well, that's the left, and therefore leftism believes in malinformation, which I would say is just not true. Or, you know, well, maybe that's the truth in America right now, but it shouldn't be.
Yeah, I would think that Ashley would say none of this malinformation and HR speak stuff is leftist or the left, and calling it the left is a smokescreen. It's obscurantism.
Exactly. And 3 years ago, I remember reading a Matt Taibbi column talking about this, about the quote unquote wokeness in schools, and he was and in the newspaper, and he was talking about journalists and teachers who were being fired at that time. Were people that the HR departments wanted to fire anyway because they brought controversy and, according to the bean counters, you know, endangered the profits of these profit-driven institutions. And they just used the woke terms as an excuse to fire people. Now, I think it's still going on.
Well, you mentioned that the... I led you to it. I mean, I set up the question, but we agree that it is the blue Democrat faction right now, which is the more authoritarian in terms of wanting to control people's thought processes, deny them information, deny them voice if they have the wrong opinions. Mm-hmm. And they issue marching orders to Silicon Valley, you know, to restrict free speech and to control the thoughts of the people, you know, using technology. And Silicon Valley has been very happy to, you know, follow those marching orders until Elon Musk bought Twitter. And, you know, now Elon Musk is the devil because he's not going to participate. You know, he's not going to be a proper cog in that machine, which leads us to the question of AI, which I think we should address on a different podcast, say KMO Show episode number 7, which will air 2 days from now. So
sure, that sounds great. I'll just sneak in one comment, though. You described the Washington Democrats as giving orders to the tech sector, and I think the relationship is a lot more symbiotic, and it's not one way. The people in the tech sector seem to be very concerned with making money. So I consider the tech sector as representing capital, and they tell certain things to the Washington Democrats, and the Democrats engage in a dialogue and tell them to do this or that. But I don't think it's Washington directing Silicon Valley. I think Silicon Valley is doing a lot of these things to make money. And even without dictates from Washington, they would be slipping a lot of this big data surveillance and some amount of censorship in there, because radical views, you know, don't make money for these tech sectors. They like to chase the middle. So even without the Washington politicians, I think the tech sector would be engaging in a lot of this, you know, surveillance and arguably even oppression.
So I want to be clear that for the most part, the power centers in Washington, D.C., which are, you know, issuing marching orders to the tech companies in terms of who to censor and how, it's not Congress doing it. It's what, you know, people would call the deep state. It's the CIA, it's the NSA, it's the Department of Homeland Security, and then most prominently, it's the FBI. Which, you know, this is the deep state. They're not elected officials. They are, you know, they linger for decades. But right now, the deep state has more of a blue cast to it than a red cast. So in a sense, it's the blue team pushing this. But, you know, when you dig a little deeper, it's not Congress. It's not the voters. It's, you know, the permanent federal bureaucracy in the law enforcement and intelligence sectors, which are dictating to Silicon Valley companies whose views should be allowed and whose should be suppressed and how severely and by what means.
For the most part, that's exactly right. That's what you get if you read the Twitter files, that there are these obscure government agencies that and political campaigns, and, you know, somebody's going to comment about, oh, well, you know, you're painting it like the left is oppressing the right, when really there's examples of far right views being censored too. It definitely goes both ways. but I think you have assessed it correctly that there's sort of a blue tinge to it right now, but it is the deep state, which is sort of beyond the red and the blue colorations. I used the phrase the Washington blob earlier. That's the sort of thing we're talking about, the career bureaucrats who want to hang on to power but not be seen using it like the elected politicians are.
Exactly. All right, well, let's jump forward in time 2 days.
All right.
So the conversation with Kevin Wolmut will be in KMO Show episode number 8. Episode number 7 I put out yesterday, and the guest was Danielle Bocelli. She's a data scientist, and well, maybe you've heard the episode already, but if not, KMO.show. All right. I'm out. Talk to you soon. Stay well.